reduced right down to a little a dockyard without any facilities for bunkering, where I had over 400 Africans kept the dockyard going, and 8 Admiralty civilians. And down at my place, at the naval base, not the dockyard. The dockyard was about 4 miles away from us, upriver. My place, I had 6 chief petty officers, RN, about 100 African ratings, no others, and 1 African petty officer, Karoma, and I had 1 officer, an engineer officer, Tom Scott, and 6 chief petty officers. That was the total RN present there, and the 6 Admiralty civilians. Great fun. I loved it. But it was very soon dominated everything there by diamonds. The government geologist, who was just retiring, was a man, the name I forget, he was a bachelor, but I played golf with him quite a lot, and his little partner, a woman who was as old and as insignificant as himself, they sort of almost held hands as we went round playing golf, and he was up country one day, and he thought that it was the right sort of place for alluvial diamonds. So when he got back to Freetown, he packed a bag and took a servant with him, and he sort of walked up country, went up by car, and when he got to the sort of various rivers there, he walked, and he put his hand down and was able to pick up diamonds just like that, all alluvial. And so he went back and didn't tell anybody, made a little bag up of diamonds, went to the governor and returned weeks later, emptied them out on the governor's table. And the governor said, "What are those?" And he said, "They're diamonds." And of course, you couldn't tell. You could have them in your possession for the rest of your life. You'd never know they're diamonds. It looked like a stone. Oh, no, rough stone. Dark, muddy, or sandy. And that was the beginning of the trouble, and it's been a trouble ever since. They called in, of course, the British government were immediately informed, and they called in De Beers, the only people to take over. And De Beers set up what was known as a Sierra Leone Selection Trust, SLST.
Is this when you went?
Yes, yes. And the SLST was all De Beers' men, but they didn't use De Beers because other people would know what it was all about, diamonds. And they went up country and they mapped the whole area and they divided it into little squares. And there'll be a lot of smuggling, so you might as well make it as accessible to the public as possible. You can go up and you could buy yourself one of those squares, and you then got a number. And they bought all the diamonds you panned out up there. You only use a sort of garden sieve and dig up and put them water in that.
Did you go up and do that?
No.
Were you never tempted?
No. I'll tell you what did tempt me, and then later, just a minute. The diamonds were then bought on the spot, with huts set up with SLST and people there, and the cash paid. So very dangerous to these people. A lot of cash up there turned into a lot of diamonds, wide open for abuse. And the only people who really wanted them, other than De Beers, were the Russians. They didn't want the gemstones. They wanted industrial stones. So they set up an embassy which was buying diamonds in the next country down, which I think is Angola, isn't it? And across a river. So there was then the awful business of people getting the diamonds, handing in some to the SLST, keeping the rest in their pocket, then going down to the river 200 miles away, getting a canoe, canoeing across, going to the Russian embassy and standing there. And, of course, that was wide open for abuse as well. Many, many people, Africans, set off and never arrived the other end. They were killed. The diamonds were taken by someone else to the Russians, and they were going in upturned canoes, and all this was happening, and it's even now, the whole of West Africa is dominated by Sierra Leone diamonds. Mm.
And that was where it all started?
That's where it started, yes, and this little man, yes, and I can't remember his name, I know it too, but he was a dear little chap, and then he retired.
He was a geologist,
yes. Mm. But right at the end of my time, and this is very naughty to tell you, I was going home by sea, and I went out by sea, and I went back by sea, and I had my wife and family and daughter out there, and we lived in a beautiful bungalow, naval bungalow, halfway up the hill, not a hill station, there was too much fog out there. I had a naval building, oh, it's a beautiful house, bungalow, and a lot of entertaining, awful lot of entertaining, big, you know, cocktail parties, 100, 150 people, very tiring, but the second in command, and I won't mention his name, of the colonial police, very big force, the police there, was the bloke who organised all the anti-smuggling in that thing. And just before, about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before we were going home, he came into my office and got a cup of tea or whatever it was, and we were talking, and he said, "Oh, by the way," and he brought out a small bag on the table and tipped out diamonds onto my table, desk. And he said, "Would you be interested in taking those home?" And I said, "Explain it to him." And he said, "You've got to get these to Liverpool. A man will meet you at Liverpool." He said he won't know you, and he won't contact you later when you've left the ship. He'll follow you. And I said, "What's in it for me?" And he said, "Well, they are worth whatever it's going to be when they have been cut." And it was something like, for me, £5,000, which was, it was about 7 years' pay in the Navy. I wasn't earning £1,000 a year then as a lieutenant commander. And I was...
Big money.
Big money, and... I said, "Give me 24 hours to think about it." I discussed it all night with my wife, and she said, "Definitely no, don't trust." She said, "You know, you've got time in the Navy, your pension, you'll lose everything." So next day he came around, and I said, "You know," he said, "you'll regret it." I said, "Well, I could regret it either way, but I'd rather regret it this way than be caught." But it was, and I don't know, he probably did it himself, I don't know. He left about a year later. But that was a terrible temptation, these things are.
But of course that chap who followed you in Liverpool would know you, and he could make you do it again. Or do something.
I know. I thought of that one too. Yes.
That was the real, real problem, wasn't it? What about the naval intelligence role in Sierra Leone?
It was mostly intelligence, nothing to do with Navy.
I'm gonna stop you just there.
Oh.
Derek Plummer, end of Reel 11. Derek Plummer, Reel 12. I'm sorry, I stopped you rather mid-sentence. So I was asking you about naval intelligence.
Well, naval intelligence really was only a very small part of it. It being an important port in wartime, we had always the idea that if war broke out again, we would reactivate Sierra Leone naval base there. And so we had a stack of books, I think about six books, for something like 40 or 50 merchant ships. If war broke out, they could come straight into Sierra Leone, into Freetown, and we would give them the books, all of which were confidential or secret, and they would then be sort of fully equipped from intelligence point of view for going back to sea again. So I had to keep these corrected. Every mail that came from London, there were corrections to this information. And correcting that number of books sets is a major task. That was really all. The rest of it was concerned with the colonial intelligence. I was on their intelligence committee working with the colonial police and that there, and it was mostly diamonds.
Right, and that's what they were mostly concerned with.
That was everybody. Yeah. They could think of nothing else.
So, from Sierra Leone, you were there did you tell me 18 months?
No, I think it was longer than that. I think I did two. Anyway, I came back at the time of Suez.
Right, okay. Uh-huh.
And I went on leave. No one told me I couldn't go on leave. I went on leave, and then the telegram started following me around the world. I shouldn't have been on leave because of they wanted me for the putting together of the requisitioning ships there to go out to the Mediterranean for the Suez campaign thing, whatever it was called. So I went back off leave, and I was told I was going to be a naval movements officer anyway, which I hadn't been appointed. I didn't know that, and I saw no reason why I couldn't go straight on leave. I'd left my address. Anyway, I went back. I finally took up a job as naval movements in Sierra Leone. By this time, of course, I decided my naval career was...
Naval movements in Southampton.
Based, but it covered Portsmouth and Southampton. I had a flat in Southampton anyway, so it suited me admirably. And I just looked after the movements of ships and people through the port. It was a deadly dull job.
Was it?
But it gave me time to go down to watch Hampshire play Surrey at cricket and things like that. Enjoy life. It was very good.
Yeah.
I'd asked to go out, and they said no, so I recognised the time was time to be a bit more disloyal to the Navy.
Mm.
But I made a lot of friends, all in the Merchant Navy, because I was dealing with merchant ships as well.
Yeah.
And the flat I'd got was from the captain of the captain of the Queen Mary, Commodore Sorrell, lived next door, little tiny man, and his painful, agonizing wife, who never stopped talking. And I got to know him very well. Unfortunately, he died shortly, about 2 months after he retired. He was writing his history of the Cunard line. He was the man who was responsible for birthing the Queen Mary without tugs in New York during a dock strike. Never been done before and would never be done again. It was almost impossible to put this enormous ship alongside float this size.
Amazing. Sheer skill as a sailor, really.
Huh?
Sheer skill as a sailor.
Yes. Yeah. Brilliant man. Brilliant. And he was telling me all about that. He was also an artist. He used to draw little pictures, quite good pictures, which he was going to put into his book. And he had a little room in his flat. He lived in a flat. A very nice flat. And 2 months later, having retired, he dropped dead.
Yeah. So you were in Southampton?
Or a couple of years, I think it was. And from there, I went out to Taiwan.
So why were you sent there? Did you request a...
No, but I had been, because of the job in Sierra Leone, I'd been into naval intelligence. And one of the people...
Tell me what naval intelligence is precisely.
That's not silly. It's very amateurish. And you didn't have to be a specialist in anything. I was specialised in doing nothing. That was my specialisation. If a job like Sierra Leone involved in a little bit of intelligence work, they claimed you and said you, as being their representative out there. When it was out in Formosa, this person who knew me just phoned me up and said, would I like to do this job out there? And I said, yes. I had no training. All I did, having agreed to the appointment to go out there, I spent a month in London, working, first of all, I had to go and see the director of naval intelligence, who was an admiral, to make sure I was okay. And I met the bloke who was going to control me out there, who ran the China desk. And that was all in the citadel. You know, the citadel is Admiralty Citadel. It's the bit with the concrete one covered in creeper of different sorts, you know. And this was, I'd never been into I've been into Admiralty many times, but not that part, the citadel. And I spent a week, or it might have been 2 weeks with them, a program all out. And I went from person to person telling me all about what I was going to do out there. Not one of the people had ever been there, but they'd all knew what I was going to do when I got there. And being sensible about this thing, there's so much to talk about. In essence, I went out to Freetown, to Taiwan, and I took a wife with me and a daughter, and I went out on the excuse that I was helping the consul out there solve the problems of merchant shipping, which was being fired at by the Chinese. I hadn't got any Chinese, I didn't know any Chinese language, but it wasn't required. And all at home, when I was out there, during my time in England, I had a week with naval intelligence, I had a week with Army intelligence, I had a week with Air Force intelligence, and I had about 4 days with MI6. And these four people, Army, Navy, Air Force, and MI6, fed questions they wanted, just questions, all the questions were collected by the China desk. God, running the China desk, and they were sent out to me by a diplomatic bag. The diplomatic bag came to Hong Kong, and every fortnight, I think it was, it came out there. So someone from Formosa, Taiwan, in the consulate, or myself, had to go over to Hong Kong, taking a diplomatic bag, getting a signature for that, picking up the outward coming one, and take it back to Taipei. And there were all the questions in the bag for me.
These were questions, they wanted factual answers.
Yes.
About the Chinese?
No, about all the military equipment out there. You see, we, as I said, we never recognized the communist regime under Mao, and the Americans did, and the Americans therefore... we didn't recognize, I'm sorry, Chiang Kai-shek with the nationalists, the Kuomintang, the nationalist government, who was sitting now with about 1.25 million of mainland Chinese, and Chiang Kai-shek himself and his wife and all his minions. They were sitting in this little island which belonged to them anyway, so they didn't invade it. They just moved over there, like us moving to the Isle of Wight. All the rest of China remained under Mao as communist. And we recognized the communist regime. We were the first major power to recognize them. We did not, therefore, agree with the Americans, who were hand in glove with the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek. And the Americans, for a change, were extremely held very close to the chest. They wouldn't tell us in England what they were doing out there. And someone had to go out and find out what the aircraft, air business, the military, and the Navy were doing. And they couldn't find an excuse. We had this consul out there, the consulate, with just purely, I think there were four in the consul. They were not equipped. They hadn't got the information to read changes in the Navy, Army, and Air Force there, and they got other things to do anyway. So when an opportunity arrived for sending someone out, which when the Chiang Kai-shek left China, before leaving, he fortified to the nth degree two groups of small islands, one off Fuchao and the other one off Mats. I forget the other one. The two islands, the groups of islands were fortified. They just sat off two of the ports on East China's coast there. And if any ship went to the enemy, of course, into mainland China, they would fire at it from these fortified things. How they managed to stay there, I don't know. They made a concrete warren in the islands. There was plenty of water. They farmed food, just enough food they got there, which also could be dropped on them, but guns everywhere, under concrete and everything else. Kromoy and Matsu were the two groups of islands, and they were always called the offshore islands by the rest of the world. And when British shipping was trying to get into Fuchao, for instance, and was fired at, and they were easy targets, they were perfectly within their rights to fire at us because we were taking supplies into their enemy, mainland China. So we couldn't bleat about them. But it did make the situation for the British a bit difficult in Formosa because here was...
So when you first arrived there in Formosa into Taiwan... What sort of a town was Taiwan? We're talking about, what was this, about 57, was it?
This is about, no, this is 59, I should think, 58, 59.
Yeah. So what sort of a town was Taiwan?
It's also on an island. It's 270 miles long, and at its widest, it's about 70 miles wide. The Tropic of Cancer goes right through the middle of it, and... it was occupied by the original Taiwanese people there. There were about 7.5-8 million Taiwanese when I was there, and there were about 2 million, 1.5 million mainland Chinese who came over to settle there with Chiang Kai-shek. They had no tourism at all. It was a fort. It was a military island, a military fort. They didn't want tourists of any sort. So
what were buildings like? Were they like sort of colonially?
Oh, no, they were primitive. They were pretty, yes. They were pretty primitive.
It's a concrete block building.
Now I saw it on television the other day. Incredible. It's like Hong Kong. I mean, they had open drainage in Taipei, the capital, and their smell was appalling. Rickshaws, very few taxis, mostly rickshaws. You couldn't go onto a beach without going through a sentry on an arm. And I lived... almost on the coast, 15 miles from Taipei, and the beach was 1.5 miles, and I could go down by car, but I had to be stopped to have a card, and I tested it several times. I took any card, I sort of made a card up, and they always said go through, because they knew my face, they didn't really look, so it wasn't important. But you couldn't get on anywhere without, it was all military.
And what was their attitude to you as a British?
I think the Chinese didn't have an attitude. They took it all as it was, and they didn't query at all. The Americans were a little fussed about it because they felt they were the bosses there, and they didn't like. They knew I wasn't there to help with the shipping, and they knew very well that I was just collecting information. But that was my job, and they made it very difficult indeed. They wouldn't tell us anything. I had a petty officer with me. We were both plain clothes. We didn't wear uniform or anything. We were both Mr. and Mrs., you know, sort of thing. And we had... But everybody knew what. So it was one of those ridiculous... I called myself the resident naval spy up there. That's what I considered myself. I found it very difficult to get, without the language, getting information.
They
but
did not taught you any language when before you left London.
Did I?
They didn't teach you any
language. No, not at all, no.
So what did they teach you? Were you using signals equipment, or how did you... The information just went backwards and forwards in the diplomatic bag?
Diplomatic bag. Everything I found out, every fortnight I sent answers to questions. They were all numbered.
What sort of questions?
Anything about the military. Then you know, we hear their new ships, or they've just such and such a thing, aircraft arrived, something has happened, there's been an accident. Everything that happened in the military world, in the true sense of the military, all the three services, I reported on if I thought it was worth reporting. That was it. It was very interesting.
Where did you get your information from?
People who were prepared to talk, which was very, very difficult. I had one very good Chinese man who ran the snake serum thing. He was extracting serum from snakes to produce an antidote, because there are a lot of snakes in the island, and he lived quite close to me. Luckily, I got away from Taipei. I had a house on the mouth of a river called Dansui, or Tamsui, and the river ran from the Formosa Straits, or Taiwan Straits of Taiwan. So if you could see far enough, you'd just see the mainland China from where I was, but it's just over the horizon. And the river ran inland up to Taipei, the capital. So my daily journey was up and down the road, which more or less follows the river. I had an office in Taipei with a consular office there. They had an office and they let me use a little bit of it. And the Americans were very, very cagey. One American did help me quite a bit. But the chap I got most of it was the senior attaché, air attaché, for the... I better not say the kind. I can't even remember where he came from now.
I think it's all long ago.
Yes. From Thailand. Yeah. He had been trained in England as an RAF pilot. He did, and he worked with the RAF, and he spoke reasonably good English. And he was an absolute gem.
Was that because he felt a loyalty to England?
Yes.
He liked the British.
Yes, yes. And
everything. It's a risky thing to do.
Yes, it is. But it was interesting. It was very interesting. Everything I did, I had to watch out for. I mean, I wanted to go up Mount Morrison, which is just under 15,000 feet, the highest part of the island. And it took me 8 months to get a pass to go up there, and the pass was for 3 days, and I overstepped it by about a day and a half. I couldn't get back in time. And when I got down to the foot of the mountain, there were a bloody great posse of blokes to arrest me. It was ridiculous. I mean, there was no evidence, there was nothing military in that the mountain at all, and yet I overstepped the mark on the time. From time to time, we did things like that, and as a direct result of that, this happened. They shut the, they confined us to our homes or offices, so we weren't allowed out. That would usually last about a week, but if it went as far as 10 days, it was unusual. They did it several times, and we just stopped issuing, we shut the consul down. The consulate was shut, and of course, as I told you, the consulate was there really providing visas for his agents to get into and out of mainland China through Hong Kong. And if he wanted one of their person to go and the consul was shut, he couldn't get a visa. So in the end, they had to give way, and they said, "We think we've punished you enough. You can now reopen the, you know, you can come out of your house." It was a formality. It was a very pleasant formality. There was no fighting or anything like that.
So Chiang Kai-shek was there.
Yes.
On Taiwan.
Yes.
What did you see, if anything, of him? His profile?
Fairly high profile. He appeared quite a lot. And, of course, Madam Chiang Kai-shek was the driving force. She was the president, not him.
So what was he like, first of all, physically?
Physically, he was a very good-looking man. He's getting on a bit. He had enormous a charisma about him. He was someone always known as the Jimo, not Chiang Kai-shek. He was the Jimo. But behind it all was Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who was a very, very good-looking woman indeed. You probably know, she was always considered to have the finest pair of legs in the world. Marlene Dietrich was her nearest runner-up. But in my opinion, Dietrich was nowhere near.
On what occasions did you meet them?
I only met them personally once, and it was the most extraordinary thing. I still don't understand. I spent my whole time out there in fear and dread of someone finding out what I was doing. And one day I got a signal, a telegram came, saying that a Mr., let's say, Robinson was arriving. Would I go to the airport, which was a pretty primitive airport, and you could walk out to the planes to meet people. This is a primitive there. He was coming by air, and I wasn't to speak to him, but I was to make myself known, and I was told what he would be doing, what he was to be wearing or carrying, a Radio Times or something like this. And we passed, we obviously had seen each other, and that was it. Now I knew who the bloke was. I wasn't to contact him. If he wanted any help, he'd contact me, which he did. And he asked, he sent me a note, which came through a Chinese colonel who used to come into my office every fortnight when a diplomatic bag was going, just before. And he told me his name, and I said, that's far too difficult for me. And I gave him an English name, and he accepted that. And he used to come every week and chat with a sealed envelope, and it went into our diplomatic bag with the consul's approval. I had no idea what it was.
What was his relationship with the consul then? The consul allowed him to... The
consul let him do it because it had been done for so long. I think it was just one of those things. Mm-hmm. He was working with the Chinese government. The government...
In
Formosa. Yeah. But he always came in plain clothes, never in uniform. And I got to know him quite well. And the message came to me from Robinson through the colonel. Deeper and deeper it gets. And it invited myself and my wife, not my daughter, to a dinner at an address. And I had a driver called Cho. And Cho didn't speak English, he told me. I found out very soon he did, so we had to be very careful. He was one of Chiang's men, definitely. Everything we did was reported. So it was very difficult to get away from. That's when the Thailand bloke was good. He had a car and a driver, and I used to go around with him, sometimes in the boot of his car, and travel 50 miles before being let out. Extraordinary fun. And this, I said to my driver, Cho, I showed him the address, and I said, tonight we go there. And he said, you know where it is? Yes, he knew where it was. And it was one of the big Japanese houses. The Japanese had Formosa for exactly 50 years. And we kicked them out after the war. They'd been there 50 years, and they went back to Japan. The Japanese had it for 50 years, I'm sorry. And the Japs were out. And whilst they were there, they'd built a railway, and they'd put some roads in, and they'd built a lot of houses for themselves. And they all had walls. So the Japanese hate being seen, so they're all behind walls. And it was one of these big Japanese houses that I'd never even been in the road. It was purely residential area. And we drove there in the car. It was dark, and there's huge double gates open when we got there, and there were sentries either side with rifles. And we went inside, round a little bed of grass, or sort of such, and parked the car by a front door, big steps up to this Japanese type with the tatami matting and no floors. And there was my colonel, who used to come in every fortnight, now in uniform, and also Mr. Robinson. And we were introduced, and we were taken into the inside, and there were no women at all. It was all military, everyone in military uniform. One civilian, Chinese, all Chinese. I knew none of them. I knew a lot of the names when I was introduced. I thought, God, I know you, but he doesn't know me, sort of thing. And then we went through to the dining room, huge table, and we all sat down. And in the table, by then, Chiang Kai-shek had arrived, and Madam. and it was absolutely spooky. I couldn't believe this was happening to me. I mean, I was out there to find out, as a spying on his territory. I met him then just before dinner with Madam, and she was the only other, my wife and Madam. I didn't have a chance to see her legs. She was wearing something long that evening, not the chongson that she usually wore. And straight after dinner, he disappeared again. But it was a sort of token gesture. He'd turned up. Robinson and myself, the two English, and my wife. And I don't know to this day what the hell it was all about. I don't know what Robinson was doing there. All I do know, it was a lot of double dealing, because it had nothing to do with what I was there for. I felt I'd been wasting my time there. If we were so close as that, why weren't we getting the information direct from them instead of sending someone out to spy on them? It was just amazing, but it happened. But the time I saw her legs was, I must tell you, the Americans had a very, very fine Air Force general called Chennault. And he had trained the Chinese Air Force in China, when they were still there in China, before they were kicked out by the communists. And single-handedly, he had trained dozens of pilots, hours of flying with Chinese pilots. And he taught. They had an air force which was tiny, but they were as efficient as the RAF. They were brilliant. And he suddenly died, and the whole of China went into mourning. They worshipped this man. They loved him. And so they set to and ordered from America, I suppose, a beautiful statue to be made in bronze, huge thing, twice life size, of General Chennault. And the big occasion was when this statue was unveiled in a park outside Taipei. They had a lot of parks, lovely parks. Now, I couldn't get there because I was persona non grata. But my friend, the Filipino, did I say Filipino? Thailand. Had a wife, and he had a ticket. It was all 600 guests, and they were all laid out in this park in front of a great big stage that had been put up there. 24 chairs on the stage, 600 laid out as like a cinema or a theatre. And the Thai bloke said to me, "I've got an invitation you can have. My wife doesn't want to go." I knew that was a lie. So I took it. I took the invitation. He picked me up. We drove there in a car. He in his uniform. You could see why he was so important. He had medals right down to his feet almost. We walked in, and he being the senior air attaché, and this being the funeral, the unveiling of a statue of an airman, General Chennault, he was in the front row. So was I. And we were right in the middle of the front row. I was in dog robbers like this. I hadn't got any uniform. I felt incredibly obvious, but no one seemed to take any notice. And then we were surrounded by soldiers, hundreds of soldiers, making sure there was not going to be a bomb or anything. I was so worried about security. And on the platform, people began to come in, and they filled up everything, the two rows of seats, except the two right in front of us. The stage was about 3 foot up. We were about 2 yards from the stage, and the first row of chairs was about a yard and a half, so it was 3.5 rows. And then everybody stood up, and in came Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang Kai-shek. And of course, you know where they're going to sit, right in front of us. We all stood for about an hour while all the national anthems of the people who recognized Chiang were played, all sounding exactly the same. And finally, we sat down, and Madam Chiang Kai-shek, wearing the chongson, that lovely split skirt, sat right opposite. I was looking straight at her legs. I couldn't look anywhere else. I couldn't look up to avoid it. I couldn't look down. I was mesmerized by these beautiful legs. And all for the next hour and a half, while all the speech was going, she moved her legs this way, that way. She opened them. I was a young man then. I can't believe that it all happened. Well, years and years after that, I got an MBE when I was in Hong Kong. And I got a very nice telegram from an admiral who knew me and had been responsible for me going out there. He's since died. And he said, "Congratulations, Derek. It was the legs that did it," because I'd written in my report in the go home and in the homeward bag that week out all about these legs. And the unfortunate thing was that most of it was official, but because I knew the bloke running the China desk, you always used to scribble a personal note to him with detail I wouldn't have put in the other. And this, he when I got the reply a fortnight later, he said, thanks for the information. And the Admiral, who shouldn't have seen his private letter, loved your comments about Madam Chiang Kai-shek. Hence the telegram some years later. Thank you. Congratulations, Derek. It was the legs that did it.
Derek Plummer, end of reel 12.